Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be talking about a subject. It is addiction. But we're going to be talking about addiction from a man's perspective, talking about other men. Our guest today is Dan Griffin. His book is titled A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps. I want to welcome you, Dan, to the show.
Oh, Donna, thanks so much for having me.
I was really intrigued when I found out about your book, and by the way, I love the cover on the front of it, A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps, and I thought, this is something that's different. It's a perspective that gives a different view, and you yourself have been involved in the mental health and addictions field for a number of years. And you, when you were in college, your graduate work was centered on, and I'll quote, social construction of masculinity in the culture of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why did you choose that as a theme, and how is it that you yourself have decided that this was a perspective that needed to be addressed?
Wow, great questions. First, what I like to say a lot of the time is that this topic chose me as much as I chose it. I ended up having two significant things happen when I was a senior in college. One is I began the process of looking at the impact of addiction on my life, both living with my father's chronic alcoholism, and then ultimately looking at my own. At the same time, I was introduced to, from the sociological perspective, gender studies. And the confluence of those two became very powerful for me once I actually got into recovery myself from addiction in May of 1994. And because I think my eyes were already open to the way that men express themselves and kind of show up in many different contexts, I was really paying attention to how men were communicating and interacting and expressing themselves in recovery meetings. And it was fascinating to me because it was a way of being and a way of communicating that you just didn't hear men doing otherwise. And it was fascinating at first for me, but then I realized that there were some significant aspects of masculinity that were actually having some big impacts on men in both positive and negative ways regarding their recovery. And as my own recovery continued and my own immersion into the field, it became really clear to me that nobody was looking at this topic. And there were some serious issues that men were not necessarily addressing. And I felt compelled to write the book.
Your dedication to your father, Dr. Owen Martin Griffin, you state, who never got the gift of recovery, the men upon whose shoulders I stand, those who walk the path with me today, and those yet to find their way. You have some very interesting questions that you pose. Now, this book, I think, would be invaluable for a woman to read, such as myself, because it presents certain paradigms that a female may generally be aware of, but if they're dealing with a male member of family that has addiction, this is a man talking to men, basically. And it really gives very, very good insights into the way men respond and the way that they think. Now, you have a question in here. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a man? Now, is this question, when you put that out, or is that a question you ask of yourself? Is it a question that you find that when you're before groups of men that are dealing with issues that you can ask them? What kind of responses did you give yourself, and what kind of responses do you get from men?
Well, I mean, that question is at the foundation of the book, and it's at the foundation of all the work that I'm doing at this point. I mean, what does it mean to be a man? If the ideas and images that I grew up with told me that men are a certain way, and then all of a sudden, through the recovery process, men are expressing themselves in certain ways that men aren't supposed to, asking for help, letting go of control, not worrying about so much their image or their reputation, showing emotions, vulnerability, intimacy, caring about relationships. So it's like, well, does that still make you a man? I mean, is it manly to do that? And so at that heart of that question is really a rhetorical opportunity for men and women, as you said, to look at that and say, well, okay, well, you know, what really does it mean for me to be a man? And it was a part of the interview that I asked every single man that I interviewed for the book. And it was really interesting for me to have the conversation with them and for them to begin to see how their idea of what it meant to be a man had implicitly, for the most part, been affected by their recovery.
Mm-hmm. Give us some examples of the things that were said to you.
Well, one of my favorite is, you know, these were mostly, I shouldn't even say mostly, these were all friends of mine from across the country. But one of them is from a gentleman, Miguel, I believe, and it's in step one. It's in the step one on the page of 33. And basically, Miguel is a very athletic guy, very attractive guy, and he has a quote that says, "I look at flowers and I think they are pretty. Is that okay? It is now. I like flowers. I've been watching this dance show. The athleticism is awesome and the talent is incredible. Would I have been caught watching that show back when I was drinking? Even if I liked it, I doubt it." Mm-hmm. Those were the insights. That was the honesty and openness that men were sharing with me that quite honestly blew me away as I was writing the book, that it really told me that I had something special here because of what the men were sharing. When they talked about the fears that they had or from experiencing abuse and what that had done to them in their sense of masculinity, their attempts to control situations and people and the pain that had caused them. Almost every part of the interview was a man basically looking at how he experienced life differently, especially as a man, as a result of his recovery.
Mm-hmm. You say that addiction is a feelings disease. Now, people would hear that and they'd say, give me a break. It seems like everything's being labeled as a disease
anymore.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm asking you, what is that feelings disease? Why did you use that combination of terms?
Okay, well, there's the layman's answer, and then there's the answer that I would give if I were, you know, at a conference for the field. And so what I'd say is, addiction has been clearly shown to be a chronic brain disease, and it affects people in the part of our brain where a lot of the emotions are regulated. So when we say that it's a feelings disease, a lot of what that means is that for so many who experience addiction, there is a dysregulation of emotions, of feelings. There is a intensity, oftentimes, of feelings. There is a lack of awareness or understanding of the feelings, but they tend to have a very significant effect on the individual, more so than it seems to be on the average person. And those feelings can drive a lot of behavior. Throughout the book, the men talked about various feelings, one of which is probably the least popular feeling for men, and that's fear. And as men got into recovery, they realized how much fear controlled their life. The awareness of that has really helped them to see the intensity and the amount of feelings has on their lives.
I was very impressed by a statement that you made relative to men, and I'll just quote it from the book. It was about a magazine ad. And in the ad, there's a very masculine arm outstretched with the palm open, ready to shake the reader's hand. There was a bottle of liquor neatly tucked in at the bottom of the page. The caption reads, "Get in touch with your masculine side." The message was clear. Real men drink. This is something that is perpetuated on so many levels in society. Advertising companies work very, very diligently to create that false image. I was watching a particular liquor ad that was on television, and I just had to laugh about the whole thing. It was so absolutely, putting it bluntly, asinine. But there are a lot of young people that see that. I'm a mature woman, so I look at it and go, give me a break, for heaven's sakes. But when you're young, when you're a teenager, when you're in your 20s, you are looking at these things and you're seeing adults behaving in said manner. You have guys that go into different environments of work, and there's often, gee whiz, you got to do this, have a half a bucket of work worth of scotch. That really shows if you can, it's just ridiculous. I know it's done with the females, but not so much as it is with the guys. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong at all. I mean, if you were to do a content analysis of all of the beer commercials or the alcohol commercials, I mean, you would see a very dominant theme, and that is exactly what you just said. It is the social aphrodisiac, I mean, for men. It gets them the really beautiful women, and of course it's only women. And it gets them, you know, the prestige, and of course it's all fun and frivolity, and, you know, and I'm not going to say that there are people who drink who don't experience that and then, you know, are not addicted. That's fine. That's true. But it's definitely marketed toward men, and I would say that you hit on something extremely important, especially for younger people, and that is that there's a vulnerability that we feel as young men trying to prove our manhood, trying to prove our manliness. And so in an attempt to do so, in an attempt to get the courage to talk to women, in an attempt to get the courage or the ability to be cool, quote-unquote, amongst the other guys or to be able to hang out with the older guys, drinking plays a pivotal role in that. And it used to be a lot stronger in the work environment, but it still shows up, and it's still there about a man can hold his liquor. You know, a real man can hold his drink. And I would say it's pervasive. Why that is, you know, I mean, it's hard to say. It's been, alcohol's been around for a very long time, and it's been predominantly a way for men to let loose and to, you know, be wild and free, and that was just not something that was really ever geared toward women. That was not something that was a perception of women. Mm-hmm. I think as gender roles are changing, we are seeing more of that, but I think the women want to be the ones a lot of the time that the guys are going after, and so there's that almost sort of tangential marketing to women.
It's a very interesting phenomena. It has been my observation through the years that many times, dependent on the persona of the individual, that when they started drinking, there would be a side of them maybe that would be displayed that could be very violent. It sometimes would be sort of teary. But most of the time, there was an aggressiveness, a brassiness, that's what I'll say, that would be demonstrated that if you were not one, if you were a female and you were not drinking, it really made you feel like you were in a very, very uncomfortable positioning. And it is something that made you feel like you didn't have much control. And there's a lot to that. And there are environments that are encouraging of that dispositioning. And I'm not against alcohol. What I'm against is not understanding how it can affect them and can destroy their lives. I've known alcoholics. My father was an alcoholic. He was what you'd call a closet alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, it ended up killing him. Mm-hmm. Now, he got into it later on in life, but it really helped to destroy his body in a phenomenal way. And I can remember when I finally learned about it, I was in my 20s, and it really surprised me because I didn't observe him being in any kind of a negative patterning. But I have no idea because I was growing up. That was not a part of my world. It was hidden. There was a lot of it that was hidden. So when it did come out, it came out as a surprise. I have a very, very dear friend who was a closet alcoholic, a woman. And I've known this woman for years. When I found out she was a closet alcoholic, it blew me away.
Mm.
I just couldn't believe it. She hid it so well. So you have these things with people. It's just amazing behavioral patterns. And a lot of it is a societal environment patterning. But I see it among all cultures. I've seen it from cultures around the world.
Absolutely. One of the things I do is I track, all the different articles about alcoholism and addiction around the world. And, you know, just recently there was something about in Kenya and in India and in one other place, and it was all about alcohol being tied to domestic violence, alcohol
mm-hmm.
being tied to the increase in car fatalities, alcohol being connected to, I think, an increase in sexual assault. And, you know, that's a worldwide phenomenon.
Yes, it is.
Alcohol affects the brain at a point where judgment is impaired, where reasoning is impaired, where impulsivity is impaired. I mean, all the behaviors that we identify with excessive drinking are the points of the prefrontal cortex that are impacted. And so we have a much better understanding of that, and so we can understand why those behaviors come about. In my book, I talk about trauma. And trauma is one of the ideas, one of the concepts that's really transforming the way we view addiction. And it's really becoming clear that so much of men's addiction and women's addiction is exacerbated or even caused by untreated trauma. And for men, and this is what's most significant about it for me, is that men tend to exhibit the symptoms of trauma externally, aggressively. And some of that has to do with the way that we're raised, and I think it has to do with other factors, but some of the most violent, angry, aggressive, rageful people, particularly when they're using, are also those who are suffering from untreated, undiagnosed trauma. And it was actually one of the big motivations for me writing this book and doing the work that I'm doing is that trauma is very, it occurs in a large number of men in the recovery community who still don't know that that's what's happening. And so while they're in recovery, a lot of the violence, the anger, the negative behaviors continue because it's being compelled by this untreated trauma.
I would agree with you. I think that there are many, many cases relating to that, like post-traumatic stress syndrome,
mm-hmm.
when you have the young men coming back. It can affect the women, but they react differently sometimes. Not always, but it's just the nature of the male, because you stated in your book that there's very much the emphasis on a quest of power, happiness, and gee whiz, you can have everything you want, but you've got to be in total control.
Yeah.
The attitude of domination.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
And I think to a degree it's a natural part of the male persona because the hunter-gatherer side is there. And let's face it, we've been around here for a few million years. So this is part of that aspect of the male that has its positive side, in that the male, if he's got a good balance within himself, wants to protect those that are not so strong and wants to be the best at whatever he can be. But one young man in your book, his name was Kerry, said he had always been taught to be tough, independent, and always in control. And I think trying to be always in control, I don't care what gender you are, somehow or another, it's going to snap back on you like a tight rubber band.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's no doubt a biological connection to male behavior. What I'm learning, what I'm seeing through my work that I'm doing is that for so many men, I mean, if you think about how men are raised, and I talk about this in the first chapter on feelings, I actually wanted to get the feelings piece out of the way first because I didn't want the book to be simply summarized as a book about men getting in touch with their feelings, because it's so much more than that. But when you think about how boys are raised, from a very, very young age, we are taught and told that the quote-unquote, what I call the softer emotions, are not acceptable. Feeling hurt, feeling scared, feeling sad, feeling insecure, that those are not okay for us to express. Now, we don't ever stop experiencing them throughout our lives. They are basic human emotions. Men and women experiencing them to different degrees, but they are common. But very early, we learn that that's not okay, and we learn to either stuff that or to hide it, and oftentimes it comes out as some form of anger. And so much of men's aggression is also this lack of authentic emotion. And so when a man is scared, instead of being able to have the ability and even the courage to say that he's afraid, ironically, he instead expresses anger or isolates or puts somebody else down. And part of the recovery process, and really part of my whole, what I consider to be mission in this work, is to help men feel comfortable, safe enough, but also to understand that it's actually more manly to be aware of how you're feeling genuinely and own that and then make a decision about how you're going to behave than to let your feelings drive your behavior with little to no awareness and going through much of your life acting as though you're angry, acting as though you're, you know, this, this, and this, when in reality there's just a lot of fear, insecurity, confusion. And so when men can feel safe enough to say, hey, I feel afraid, it can be an extremely liberating thing. Because, again, there's no man on the face of this earth who doesn't experience fear. And so it's just about being able to be more authentic in that.
You bring out a couple of points in your book that I think is absolutely imperative, and I don't know of any mature male that would disagree with them in any way, shape, or form, and mature women. You state in your book, if you want to be a man and live in relationship with others, you need to assume your responsibilities as an adult. This process involves the willingness and maturity to grow and develop character. Now, you also say in another section of your book that the question needs to be asked by the individual, what kind of man does he want to be?
Yes.
We need to ask ourselves these questions because we don't really know, because many of us have had poor role models. And I think that is paramount. I really do. I really think that there is such a need. I think of Big Brothers organization, Big Sisters, Big Brothers. That group of people, the volunteers for that, are doing such a service when they're able to be around, you know, adult males being with young boys, providing an example, because they have to be taught. This is something that is so important. And I know there's someone that I'm very close to that made a comment and has repeated it over and over again. He has said, it's an interesting thing that nature does. Girls enter into puberty, and somehow or another, not 100%, but they transform into women because of the biological aspect. There is a maturation that occurs with girls. It's phenomenal. With boys, if they're not taught, if they don't have good role models, they stay little boys all the way through adulthood. And he said, this just is not, they need to have good role models. And I really appreciated that comment in your book, coming from a man, recognizing it, and I would just say, this is phenomenal. I mean, how many guys are out there acting like 15-year-olds, and then they wonder why their wives divorce them, they can't have decent relationships, they are drunk as skunks or involved in some other addiction, and they sit in their pity pots and say, gee whiz, it doesn't have anything to do with me. What does it take for them to grow up?
Well, you know, I mean, that is that's a huge piece of the book. It's about growing up. It's about maturing.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, emotional maturity is not the easiest thing to happen. Now, I don't know that it necessarily naturally happens to girls. I'm not going to debate that. But what I will say is that for boys, it clearly is a huge issue. And I think, again, where it can be centered is in the fact that for boys to become men, it continues to require a deep rejection of a core part of who we are. Mm-hmm. And that immaturity really comes from that schism, I think, because I literally have grown up in recovery. I was 22 years old, and I probably was as mature as a 12-year-old, 13-year-old. I started drinking when I was 14, so, you know, right around there. And there's a saying that you stop growing emotionally when you start drinking. So when you get sober, you're around that age. And that certainly was true for me. And so I really have grown up. But so much of my immaturity has been two things. Has been a lack of awareness of what I was feeling. And again, I think that's where some of that comment of addiction being a feelings disease comes in. But in all honesty, Donna, another big piece of it has been also the untreated trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are guys who have had no trauma who just act like jackasses.
Yeah, and gals do too. I'm telling
right.
you, I've known a few.
But, you know, you probably see it more common with boys, and that's another piece that I try to get at, because
mm-hmm.
I do think that boys/men are allowed to act like that and get to think that they get to act like that, partially because, in all fairness and honesty, women and men allow them to,
mm-hmm.
and there's a sense of entitlement that young boys still can grow up with in thinking that, you know, especially young white males, I mean, it's really easy for young, white, middle-class, middle-upper-class males to grow up thinking that the world not only owes them something, but that it's their right to get it. And I think there's a lot of immaturity in that. There's a lot of self-centeredness. It creates a lot of problems for a lot of men. And so it's not just about immaturity. It's about creating a healthy masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of guys who don't, quote-unquote, act immature, but I would not want to be the kind of man that they express if you paid me, because they are still shut down. You know,
mm-hmm.
there seems to be an aspect of who they are that it's like the training that they've had to become men is so strong in them that they've really lost sight of who they could really be. If given the permission, or if they were to take the risk.
I agree with you. And there's just so much that's in your book that I think speaks well to enabling anyone who wants to read about men and their perspectives and how they look at things. And I think you've expressed yourself so well. A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps. Dan, what's your website where people can go and check it out?
It's www.dangriffin.com. You can purchase the book on there. You can go to my Facebook page. I love to interact with folks. And then they can also sign up to be on my listserv. I have a monthly newsletter, and I actually send out a free excerpt from the book when you sign up.
Wonderful. A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps. Life is always challenging. Men and women each have their own way of looking at life. And I think it's good that Dan took the time to write down what not only he has experienced, but what he has found in working with other men as well. And it's always a challenge, but it's good to be able to talk openly about things like this and to be able to, again, gain a perspective that otherwise you might not be able to understand or have the capability of seeing in the first place. Dan Griffin, it's been a pleasure having you as a guest. Your book, A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps, I'd recommend highly to anyone, especially if you ladies that are listening have someone in your life that you love dearly and you want to have a deeper understanding of perhaps why they are acting the way that they are with their addictions. This is a must read. Dan, thank you for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Thanks much, Donna.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna, and welcome back. I want to let you know, if you want to call in, the telephone number to call in to is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Well, we're just ecstatic here in the Pacific Northwest. The sun is actually visible. We are free of the overcast gray. It's a wee bit chilly. We're in the 60s. Yes, we're not going to be getting up into the 70s until about Sunday, I think it is. But we're just thrilled that the sun actually came out and blessed us. I'm telling you, it's absolutely wonderful to look up and see these gorgeous skies that are actually blue instead of pewter gray. Speaking of that, I wanted to share a cute little, a lovely poem by Edwina Mansell. And there's this magnificent illustrated photo that I've got in front of me. Excuse me, I heard the beep. And I know we've got a caller on the line, so I'll get to you in just a moment. It's not a photo is going to illustrate what I said. I've reversed my words there. Green grass like silk ribbon, a sky shining bright, the fragrance of flowers drifting through the light. Roses and hollyhocks, a wisteria vine. Beautiful summer, you're simply divine. Absolutely, Edwina, you just got it right. I really appreciate that little poem that she had. And for those of you listening, if you want to call in 888-815-9756, I've got a bunch of stuff to share with you. But first, let's go to this caller. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Veronica, and I'm calling in from Phoenix.
Okay, did you say Veronica?
Yes.
All right, Veronica, welcome to the show. First thing that I'm looking at with you is stand still. I feel as if I am being held back. It's as if there is an electric wire fence in front of me. And if I try to move forward, I get a shock. And so I stand back. You are in this standstill positioning. I don't think it's going to last very much longer, maybe 2 to 3 weeks. What I'm observing with you is a sense of frustration, and I would say relax, because this is totally out of your control. The standstill situation is just what it is. So what you want to do is to keep yourself occupied and or active with those activities that are going to enable you to have this feeling of accomplishment and satisfaction that you've been working so hard to attain. Some travel is coming up for you, might be 3 or 4 months down the road, but I'm seeing you making plans in advance of being able to participate in whatever the activity is. And you are saying to yourself, I really want to give myself this gift of time to play, to do whatever I want to do. And I think that's smart. I think it's a very good idea. And if you just save little batches of money at a time, before you know it, you'll have what you need for the trip. So you, through good planning, discipline savings, you are going to find yourself being able to take that trip that you really want to take to an area that I don't think you've been to before. So it looks like you're being a bit of the adventurous, and I want to say go for it. What would you like to ask me about today?
I just started a job this morning. And
congratulations.
Thank you. I was wondering if you saw them keeping me. I got some feedback, and it wasn't 100%. I did express an interest, a passionate interest in improving. There was a comment made that I was extremely nervous, and I just...
Well, you were. You were nervous. You're okay. Just relax. That's not a criticism. It's all right. You're fine. You're human.
And so you see them keeping me?
Yes, dear. Let me ask a question. What kind of work are you doing?
It's in communications, and I'm dealing with the public. And there were just some other circumstances that were factored into it. And I love it, so I don't want to lose out on this opportunity. And when you saw the standing still and being held back, I was wondering if it had to do with that.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if it did. And I'll tell you why. If this was your first day on the job, there is not a job on this planet that you're necessarily going to walk into and just go, woohoo, I got it all together, Deb. Make way for me. Here I come. Shoo. It doesn't work that way. You have to learn the ropes. And if you are so afraid of being let go, your fears are absolutely going to paralyze you. You're going to be like a deer that's, blinded by headlights. Drop the fear. You have been hired. They obviously saw something in you. And I want to say, lighten up and be easygoing on yourself. Say, you know what, it is my first day. And they'll understand that. They're recognizing that you are nervous. There's nothing bad about that statement. You can take, phew, yeah, sure was. I really, man alive, I just really didn't know what exactly to do at that moment. But, hey, I'm going to have this whipped and in shape and nothing at all, in no time at all. So you just need to take a deep breath you're never going to be 100% doing anything except being 100%, hopefully, awake while you're on the job the very first day. Now, if you, let's say in a month, are still not with it, then they might have something different to say to you. But your nervousness was very, very obvious, and I don't think that came as a surprise to anybody. And yes, there may be some people criticizing you because you don't have everything perfect the first day, but who does? Nobody does. At least I've never met anybody on the first day of the job where they had everything, you know, knocked down into place. You need to get over being in the position of learning. And the fact that you are in this positioning of learning, just be grateful you've got the opportunity. Don't panic. You don't need to be so terrified that you literally freeze. So you don't, just take it easy. Relax about this. If you're working with people, have a smile on your face, have a good feeling in your heart, and just know that you're going to give it the best you've got. And also, if you have other people around you, ask for their help. If you don't understand something, you're dealing with a customer, say, I need to let you know that this, I've just started here, and I apologize for not being as fast as maybe I should be. But I'm brand new, and I'm so delighted that I'm able to serve you. Will you wait for just a moment until I get the answer you need? That is so very important. People don't mind. If someone said to you, this is my first day on the job, thank you for being so patient with me, how would you react?
Well, I'm used to being, you know, pretty calm and composed. I just didn't want them to consider that it was not a good choice for them to take me on.
This is your first day. Believe me, they're going to need more time to figure that out. I don't think you're going to have a problem at all. But remember, if you have that attitude and you're trying to figure out what they're thinking, and you're assuming that they're going to fire you, you could easily sabotage yourself, for that's exactly what they're going to do. So don't go
there.
I'm serious. It's a habit. You were told what?
When they told me I was going to start, they said they would give me 2 to 3 weeks. And I did go in and talk to the higher-up today, and that was the first words out of his mouth. He said, well, you were nervous. And I just explained some things, you know, and we talked. Then I left. I'm going to give it my all, and if it, you know, just hope to manifest the best.
Look, you don't need to hope. They hired you because they saw you as being a person that can do the job. You can do the job. Stop expecting the worst.
Okay.
If you have to, go out at your lunch hour, walk around the block, take deep breaths, go into the ladies' room if you feel like you're really getting stressed. Again, you're in a new learning environment. So be patient with yourself. Again, people will see. You are under observation. That is absolutely true. So get up, look at it, say, today I give my best, have a smile on your face, and just get excited about learning new things. You're going to do fine.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. You have a wonderful day, and congratulations on your new job.
Thank you.
This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break in just a moment, quick like a bunny. Before we do, I want to let you know, tomorrow we're going to be talking about 101 great ways to enhance your career. This is a super publication, and we're going to be talking with Michelle Ricklin. So by golly, we're going to find out exactly, you've got a lot of options, but exactly what someone can do, and there's, as I said, a lot of options to look at. Donna Sebo, we're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. Tomorrow we'll be talking about different ways that we can enhance our career, improve ourselves so that we can be out in the marketplace working. And the young lady that called in a moment ago, well, I can empathize with that. I can remember what it was like when I would show up in a new environment and you just go, am I going to ever get this straight? But I'll share something with you that I did. I was working with National Cash Register. And when I went in and got my job, one of the things that I did, and I don't know what made me do this, it was just something I did instinctively. I had been on the job for about 2 months, and I asked to make an appointment with my boss, and I was in that learning curve because this was a very large company, and I was working as a receptionist at the time, and I went into the boss that I had, and I asked him, I would like to know if there's any way that you feel I can improve on the job. And it so stunned him, because in all of his years of working with employees, there had not been one employee ever that had gone in asking what the observation was of their work, and if they had any comments or suggestions, would you please let me know about them? And he was so stunned, I can remember him looking at me and telling me that nobody had ever done this. And he proceeded to tell me about some things that he felt I should be aware of, and I thanked him for that. And he said, you're quite unique. You're quite exceptional because you're asking in advance. I think my review was at a 3-month point. And I said, well, if I can do it better, then I'd like to know about how I can do it better. What is it that you would like done differently? It makes a difference when you are of a mindset when you're in a job, especially a brand new one, where you realize that you maybe need to find out about things that you're doing. Ask, what do they feel you can improve upon? And it really puts you in front in the sense that most people don't do that. Most people will wait for someone to make a comment to them, and if they do, then they take it so personally that it's really tough to be able to make an adjustment. It's too easy to get a chip on the shoulder. You don't need that. If you're on a job or within a working environment, remember what you want to do is always give the very best that you possibly can. If it is an environment that you're really not suited for, then you need to find yourself another positioning. But I think it's important for us to take a level of personal responsibility and accountability to recognize what we're really good at and what we're not. Lots of times experience is what teaches us that. And then we'll become aware of what our strengths are, what our weaknesses are, and we can move forward in that positioning that we really want to see ourselves in. But it takes time. It really takes time. And I've yet to know of a boss anywhere. I know there are exceptions to this. But wherever you go, people are going to realize that you do have that learning curve. It takes time to get to know how to do things. That's usually why someone will be assigned to an individual within a company. I did have a job once that I was involved with. It was a very, very involved positioning. And I had to pass a couple of tests to be able to qualify, and I did. And by golly, I was in an environment where they didn't give training. They honestly did not give any training. I guess they figured you were supposed to get it by osmosis. Well, that job positioning lasted a little bit over a year because I really was not in the right place. And it wasn't that I was with dumb people. Quite the contrary. I was with super intelligent people. But they didn't take it into consideration that training could really help. So I've seen both sides of the fence. So it's not one side that's better than the other. It's just give the best that you've got wherever you are, and you're going to come out ahead. Whether it's on that job or in another environment, you're going to win. I wanted to talk for just a moment about mirage cities. Now, all of us know that you can be in a desert and you can see a mirage. Things will look they'll just look absolutely phenomenal, and they're not what they seem. Well, going back into history, this is something a lot of people have experienced. But there was a silent city of Alaska that had been talked about for generations. And in the late 1800s, the Duke of Abruzzi decided he was going to search for this silent city of Alaska. Apparently, there is this city that shows up in the sky every year in a glacial region of the Alaskan coast. Now, there's been a lot of history about this mirage. Among the Alaskan Indians, prospectors as well as scientists have told of seeing the image. And it says it looks like old, old, old cities. They're just all illuminated there in the sky. They've also said this mirage that is in the silent city of Alaska has been likened to the one that is in Bristol, England. What they find so interesting in the recorded history is that the cities, as they are seen by people, whatever generation sees them, they describe them exactly the same. Fascinating stuff. This has been going on for hundreds of years. The people that were a part of the Abruzzi's expedition said they saw houses, well-defined streets. There were rose-tall spires over big buildings, which all the people that have ever seen them that recorded the information said it looked like ancient mosques or cathedrals. And there was a man by the name of C.W. Thornton that said it required no effort of the imagination to liken it to a city, but was so distinct that it required instead faith to believe that it was not in reality a city. There was another report describing this phantom city as it was. And then a prospector managed to take a photograph of this aerial spectacle. And there was an L.B. French of Chicago who said, "We could see plainly houses, well-defined streets and trees. Here and there rose tall spires over huge buildings, which appeared to be ancient mosques or cathedrals." Sound familiar? Yes, that's what other people had said. It looked more like an ancient European city. So a sky city has been seen over Scotland's Orkney Islands. Wonderful white buildings, distant land, similar descriptions. And at one time, this vision in the sky lasted for 3 hours. The people that live in the environments where this city mirage is seen. They say it. They believe it to be the crystal and pearl city of the mysterious thin folk. In the last 400 years, reports of sky cities or islands have been appearing and recorded diligently. My goodness, we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Siebel. Life is full of mysteries and wonderful, wonderful things. Enjoy them. And don't be concerned that you may not understand everything. Hey, that's the way life goes. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.